Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Prospect Lives. Each month, our family of seven writers discuss their differing views of modern life for Prospect magazine. Spanning a wide section of society, their reflections provide a window into their particular worlds and an insight into how they navigate their way through the challenges life throws at them. This month, our Displaced Life writer, Jason Thomas Fonillier, makes a reappearance to announce a truly exciting development in his story of seeking asylum in the UK, when he went to the Immigration Tribunal for the hearing of his judicial review appeal against the Home Office decision to refuse him asylum claim. Meanwhile, farmer Tom Martin expresses his concern about the farming protest movement being co-opted by conspiracy theorists. On a lighter note, Anglican priest Alice Goodman looks to fictional clerics for divine inspiration. But let's begin with Jason, who travelled to Bradford Immigration Tribunal for his hearing.
Dear gentle reader, let's conclude my story of seeking a new life here in the UK. In 2016, I had my first tribunal hearing in Bradford, West Yorkshire. The version of myself that entered the court building all those years ago was so naive and underprepared. I lacked proper legal representation. I was also emotionally unbalanced by my recent experiences, and clearly this showed. I received a refusal decision from the judge a few weeks later. It took me a long time to process this and to regain my strength to battle the Home Office again. In the years between 2017 and 2024, I lodged appeals against the refusal decision. It was relentless, but I learned a great deal about myself and about what truly matters to me. I also learned to live my life with purpose. And so, when I returned to stand before the Immigration Tribunal in Bradford this February, I felt calm. As I walked in, I had a sense of person I've become, of how much I've grown since I first arrived in this country. The weather was not welcoming in Bradford. There in the courtroom, I felt like I had people on my side. My barrister was to my right, my friends were there behind me for moral support. I was not frightened by the Home Office representative sitting to my left. It could not have been more different to the situation in 2016, where I had no one but myself. As the judge entered the room with a smile, he immediately set the tone for the hearing. His patient and calm demeanor just flowed, making everyone feel at ease about the proceedings. He informed me of the protocols, my rights, and told me that if at any time I felt what was being said about me was too much to hear, I could ask for a break. I felt so comfortable with myself. As I answered the Home Office barrister's questions, as well as the judge's, next was a witness statement from an employee at a charity I volunteered with. Then it was time for my barrister to put forward our arguments as to why my judicial review should be permitted. She was incredible. both erudite and heartfelt. Her words made such an impact. I knew then that I had hit the jackpot in finally getting a solicitor and barrister who supported and believed in me. My case was complicated, but their focus never strayed. They were passionate about securing my safety and freedom. At the end of proceedings, I felt pure joy because I was proud of my solicitor, my barrister, and myself. We worked so hard. The judge told us he would give his ruling within 3 weeks. I already waited 9.5 years, so I knew that I could stand it. Patience is a virtue. My grandfather always used to say to me, and it's a virtue that I cultivated. On 11th March at 6:03 p.m., I received a call from my solicitor. She told me she had some good news and that my judicial review appeal had been allowed. There are no words to describe how I felt.
For Sarah Collins, who suffers from OCD, a Zumba class has become a form of therapy.
It's Tuesday night and Marina, my Zumba instructor, is shouting into her microphone. "I can't hear you," she says sternly, as 20 women of all ages stomp across the floor. "Still can't hear you," she shouts, lowering the music so that we are forced to turn up the volume of our feet. Watching myself dance in the mirror, I feel a sense of dread and frustration about how different my body looks from how it did when I was 22. But then the track changes from salsa to hip-hop. My self-criticism is swept away with the music. I suspect that Marina was an award-winning choreographer in another life, because her Zumba sessions have none of the stilted, corny, jazz hands feel that many other dance-based exercise classes suffer from. Instead, the moves are creative and sassy. Marina weaves a sense of narrative, of humour, of playfulness into the routines. Halfway through the class, I'm red-faced with exhaustion, but also exhilaration. Even the shy new starters are swinging their hips with abandon. But afterwards, as I stagger back to my flat with aching legs, my thoughts turn to the complicated relationship that I've had with exercise, and a conversation that I shared with an OCD psychologist years ago when I was in my final year at university. I had an unusual clinical profile at that time. Obsessions and compulsions were derailing my life and regular panic attacks were impacting my functioning, but I had a cheerful manner and a broadly positive mood. When the psychologist asked me how much exercise I did, I replied, "Quite a lot." But in truth, this was a gross understatement. I was a competitive athlete training 4 times a week with the University Badminton Club. "Never stop doing so much exercise," he responded, explaining how it encourages the body to produce endorphins that can protect against depression. Sadly, I did stop, or at least I slowed down. After university, and as my commitments and responsibilities increased with age, my activity decreased and episodes of bad depression duly followed. Integrating exercise into my weekly routine became a constant challenge, and I still often feel that I'm not getting the balance right. Not that I got the balance right in the past either. As a teenager, I trained even more than I did at university and craved the pain that came from an exhausting sprint session. Temporarily, the exhaustion would obliterate my anxious thoughts. As well as a coping strategy, I also used over-exercising as a handy self-flagellation tool for perceived deficiencies in my appearance. My approach bordered on the kind of unhealthy addiction that is now actively encouraged by many social media influencers. Now I know that exercise should never be a means of self-punishment, and I am beginning to realise that the link between movement and mental health is about something even more powerful than the astonishing mood-boosting power of endorphins. In the modern world, exercise is one of the ways we remind ourselves that we are bodied creatures, that we are animals rather than just floating minds. Office workers like me spend an average of 70% of our waking hours sitting, as well as putting us at risk of serious health conditions like diabetes. This robs us of our sense of our physical selves. As I try to build more exercise back into my routine, I'm focusing on activities that allow me to connect with my body on a more spiritual level. Instead of lifting weights or pounding the exercise bike in the gym, I've chosen Marina's class, and it is genuinely one of the highlights of my week. And I'm not alone in this sentiment. Many of the other women who attend regularly share it aloud to each other at the end of the sessions. The sense of well-being that I feel at Marina's class makes me think about one of the key principles of the therapy approach I follow for my OCD, acceptance and commitment, or ACT. ACT teaches us that emotions are experienced mainly in the body, not the mind. Notice your faster heartbeat, a tightness in your chest, or most commonly for me, a dull ache in your jaw. When I finish my Zumba class, I feel like I have physically processed some lingering emotions. I am reminded of what my body can do, and in the process, escape my mind. But rather than relying on pain to do so like my teenage self did, I escape through joy.
Farmer Tom Martin has concerns about the direction No Farmers, No Food protests are heading.
Last month, we took a world tour of farmer protests discussing the causes and the catalysts. This month, we look at the third C of the protests, conspiracy. In the latter part of February, there was a series of protests in Wales against the latest government proposals for agricultural funding. The least popular of these was a requirement to return 10% of farmland to woodland and manage a further 10% as habitat, a pretty blunt instrument of a policy proposal, where a scalpel is perhaps required. At the front and centre of these demonstrations has been the latest protest group here in the UK, No Farmers, No Food. On a recent car journey across East Anglia, I saw numerous yellow signs bearing the slogan in villages, on motorway bridges and on farm gates. The farming press, countryside media and mainstream publications have been digging into the organisers behind this group. On the 23rd of February, a group of farmers protested under the No Farmers, No Food banner at the seat of the Welsh Government, the Senedd, in a highly publicised event. Rishi Sunak also attended to show his support, or, some might say rather cynically, to criticise the Labour-led Welsh Government in an election year. You would expect then to find headlines talking of farmers unifying, speaking truth to power, gaining public support and raising awareness of their plight. Not so for The Observer, which led with Sunak stands with net zero and climate conspiracy group at farming protest. Seemingly more column inches, or truthfully, social media feeds, were dedicated to the founder of the group, James Melville, than to the cause itself. Melville is the son of a farmer and a communications specialist who says that he wants to help our farming industry. But he also uses his considerable influence on GB News, Al Jazeera and X, where he has nearly 500,000 followers, to challenge accepted wisdom on climate breakdown, share conspiracy theories about net zero, and make claims about COVID that have been refuted by fact-checkers. The No Farmers, No Food social media accounts have posted on subjects ranging from limiting solar farms to challenging net zero goals. Supporters replying to posts from the group often share popular conspiracy theories. Martin Williams from Herefordshire was one of the first farmers contacted by Melville to join a No Farmers, No Food WhatsApp group. "It was bloody awful," he said, "absolutely toxic. They were fighting amongst each other about the COVID, anti-vax, uprisings against the WF. They wanted a riot." There is no doubt that the industry is under huge pressure at the moment across the UK and across all sectors, from horticulture to fisheries to dairy farming. The risk is that an organisation with a great message, but whose founder has the media presence of Melville, will continue to attract those with extreme and unusual views, amplifying those messages at the expense of important demands for the farming community. Melville is a communications specialist who must understand that the best thing he can do for his campaign is to distance himself from it. There is a cadre of excellent farmers making up part of the No Farmers, No Food leadership who could and would continue with clear and effective communication. Whenever Brexit and farming is discussed on social media, I see comments saying that farmers voted for Brexit and should simply deal with any negative consequences. When pushed, people who make those comments tell me that they know all farmers voted for Brexit because of the signs they saw in farmers' fields. They'll say, "Well, I didn't see any Vote Remain signs in fields around here," as it's commonly put. I respond by saying that the picture is more complex than that. On the whole, farmers voted in line with other demographic characteristics like age. In politics, perception is reality, and a cloud of conspiracy risks conflating key messages about the future of food production and environmental stewardship with a smorgasbord of nutty views. And I, for one, don't want to spend the next 10 years as an agricultural apologist unravelling this.
After Alice Garnett is trying to challenge the nihilistic, doomerist narrative often associated with her generation.
Generation Doomer is one of the less favourable labels given to Gen Z. But unlike the patronising and often overused term, snowflake, I can understand this one. My own worldview is quite cynical. It's obvious in the way I write and in the way I respond callously to grown-ups who ask me about my future. I've been told I'm too young to be so jaded. The world ought to be my oyster. Instead, the world feels like a clam, and no matter how many times I bash it against a rock, it simply won't relinquish the pearly goodness within. I read an article, watched a TikTok, in which someone explained how existentialism has become Gen Z's alternative to religion. With social media producing fresh microtrends and subcultures every single day, our generation lacks a collective culture. We don't all tune in to the same TV shows. We stream whatever we like via Netflix or iPlayer. There are no punks or hippies. The subcultures we do have are nicher than these categories. They include coquette core, eclectic granddad core, and various other cores, which each signify their own extremely unique aesthetic. The algorithm pigeonholes us into small digital communities, creating the most divided generation there has ever been. I am not a religious person. Like much of my generation, I was raised by atheist Gen X parents. Very few of my peers attended church beyond the visits mandated by my Church of England primary school. The closest I've come to a religious experience is belting out, "He's got the whole wide world in his hands," in our morning assemblies. Granted, I do have the odd friend who identifies as religious and believes in a god. I envy them a little bit. Places of worship offer a sense of community, and what's more, believing in a greater order of the universe provides a purpose and a clear set of values to live by. The challenge now, for many young people, is figuring out why we're here, where we're going, and what it is we're actually about. Because if we don't believe in God, what do we believe in? If we're not working towards some higher purpose, what on earth are we doing here? We can begin by believing in a better world. We must depart from existential nihilism and embrace hope if we are to move forward. I've become familiar with hope-based messaging at my new job, working in marketing for a climate activism app. Having had no formal experience in the activist space, I have been reading up on how best to talk about climate change in a way that encourages action. Currently, most of the media we consume around the climate crisis invokes terror. We doom scroll through wildfires, floods, and famine, all of which is sandwiched jarringly between theories about Kate Middleton's whereabouts and comically dystopian images from Glasgow's immersive Willy Wonka experience. At best, we're utterly desensitised to the climate crisis. At worst, we're terrified by it. Either way, the majority of us are paralysed. I remember impassively viewing videos of forest fires raging across Australia, the scale of the disaster barely registering in my brain. We scroll and scroll and scroll, spending only a couple of seconds on footage that, for those living it, will fundamentally change the rest of their lives. But the hard truth is that people don't want problems. Problems require our energy and our attention, both increasingly scarce commodities. And so many of us guiltily turn away. What if, instead of problems, we offered up solutions? Here, there is another hard truth. We do have the solutions. We just need to convince the likes of Jeff Bezos to fucking implement them. Since realising that we do have the solutions, and beginning to fixate on that as opposed to the problem, I have become somewhat of an optimist. So if you want Gen Z to stop being such doomers, start offering them solutions. Give us the tools necessary, be that knowledge or economic power, to fix the world, and we will do it. Someone just needs to help us make a start.
For sports superfan and journalist Emma John, her obsession with sport has recently taken a new shape.
When Nick Hornby wrote Fever Pitch, he wasn't just revealing what it meant to be a football fan. but what it meant to be anyone whose sporting passion dominated their lives. Hornby's love for Arsenal tyrannised his waking existence in a way that was becoming ever, quote, less reasonable and less attractive in his 30s. His book is an all-time great precisely because it captures a stubborn disinclination to grow up and stop taking the game so seriously. Sport can mean many different things to us throughout our lives. When I was young, it was less of a conduit to physical activity than a teaching concept, created by adults to introduce me to life's fundamental unfairness and cruelty. It was brutal enough that I was forced to run around in the freezing cold or withering heat when I would rather have been indoors reading. The fact that I was expected to do so in competition with others and to suffer the disappointment and humiliation of defeat provided a multi-pronged lesson in human social systems. As a teenager, my sudden and overwhelming obsession with cricket offered an emotional surrogate. This newfound love of the game was a convenient receptacle in which my bin fire of adolescent hormones could burn safely. Sport was doing a lot of heavy lifting as a major part of my identity, not to mention putting in its regular shifts as pure escapism. Now in middle age, I find it serves very different needs. I have observed many of my sports-loving friends follow the same trajectory, as their tribalistic fervour mellows and their enjoyment of a game rests less on the outcome than on the entertainment it provides. It's not a universal instinct by any means, but the oldest, wisest and happiest fans I know seem to share an understanding, built on decades of experience, that the best of sport is not the earthly moment of victory, but the privilege of watching athletes tilt at divinity. I have not yet achieved this guru-level enlightenment, but I have noticed how the narratives I'm drawn to are changing as I age. For instance, I have been closely following the fortunes of Luton Town, my hometown football club, as they navigate their first ever season in the Premier League. The jubilation at their return to the top flight of English football, an apparent vindication of their game after being kicked out of the league around a decade ago, was soon tempered by the harsh reality of surviving in such a merciless environment. Luton's performances throughout the season have been full of heart. They have frequently frustrated higher quality opposition. Clubs such as Chelsea, who have spent around £1 billion on their squad since 2022, compared to Luton's £25 million. Bedfordshire side's most valiant efforts have included score draws against Liverpool and Newcastle and a 4-3 defeat to Arsenal, who scored the winner in the 97th minute. Luton have often looked good enough to secure a much-needed point in the table, only to concede a heartbreaker of a goal. And it has been tough to see a group of players displaying such determination and team spirit look destined all the same for relegation. If I were a decade younger, much the age that Hornby was when he wrote Fever Pitch, I would be agonising over the results to the point that I would be quite unable to enjoy the glamour fixtures which, this time last year, Lutonians still barely dreamed of. Perhaps it is because I have been facing my own midlife wobbles then, that I have found their bottom-of-the-table performances utterly inspiring this season. The value of a never-say-die attitude does not rest solely in its eventual success. There is a nobility to their efforts, true, but there is more too. There is hope and faith and the unspoken knowledge that to be in the game at all is the realisation of a dream, even if it's not always a delight. When I was a child, I thought sport was about the good feeling that you get when you win. Now I'm wondering if it's just one more way that humans attempt to wrestle with their mortality. Hornby described his footballing compulsion as a protest against the, quote, paler, duller shades of everyday life, and the realisation that growing up was something that everyone at some stage must choose. Even his development wasn't arrested forever. He has told interviewers he couldn't write Fever Pitch today because he doesn't have the same lack of perspective. Like him, I miss the version of my fan self that, quote, had the time and the energy for all that angst and passion. But I welcome the new revelations that sport still has to bring. Even his development wasn't arrested forever. He has told interviewers he couldn't write Fever Pitch today because he doesn't have the same lack of perspective. Like him, I miss the version of my fan self that, quote, had the time and the energy for all that angst and passion. But I welcome the new revelations that sport still has to bring.
Hi, I'm Alice Goodman. I'm a Church of England vicar out in the country east of Cambridge. And I've been thinking a lot about real and imaginary clergy recently, and for good reason. There's a story told of Richard Charters, formerly Bishop of London, arriving at Theological College. The young men were given an icebreaker. What clergyman had most inspired their model of priesthood? One spoke of his grandfather, another of his college chaplain, and so forth. Then it was Charters' turn. Archdeacon Grantley in Barchester Towers, he said. I hope this story is true. When I came up to the same theological college many years later, they were still asking that question, and I had trouble coming up with an acceptable answer. By opening the question to the ranks of the fictional, Charters had made the conversation a whole lot wilder, more truthful, and more fun. Don Camillo, for instance, is a presence on the days when you're feeling beleaguered and irascible and need an extra reminder to go into the sanctuary to talk to Jesus. The young priest in Georges Bernanos' Diary of a Country Priest has for years been someone I turn to in loneliness and failure, and for that one exhilarating motorbike ride. Adolphus Irwin, the rector of Broxton and Adam Bede, is another inspiration, especially for his domestic distractions and his honesty when he falls short. Who, after all, can measure up to Chaucer's parson? When I ask around, there are some surprises. Your vicar may be the one who looks to Sterne's Parson Yorick, or to Dr. Sin, alias the Scarecrow, with his long list of transferable skills. Anthony Trollope's clergy are everywhere still. One of my favourites is Mr. Crawley, the painfully proud vicar of Hogglestock in Framley Parsonage. You may have noticed that there aren't many women in this list. There are a few about, mostly solving crimes, which I find makes them harder to imagine as colleagues. What would Merrily Watkins do? She would look winsome, recite St. Patrick's breastplate, and go herring across Herefordshire to lay a ghost or two. Female clergy, or lady vicars, as we're generally known, became part of the British cast of characters by means of television. I learned this quickly as a curate. When refueling my car, someone would shout across from another pump, "Hey, Geraldine!" Or more formally, "Has anyone ever said you look just like the Vicar of Dibley?" The answer would have been, "It has been mentioned." Since it was enough to have dark hair, a clerical shirt, and any kind of bosom. Vicar of Dibley appeared in 1994, the same year that women were first ordained to the priesthood of the Church of England, and almost instantly made women in holy orders imaginable. So, for instance, a cab driver explained to me that he was a Bible-believing Christian. He said he had thought that lady vicars were unscriptural until he read about the prophetess Huldah in the second book of Kings. And then he came round and later realized that there were many other similar females in Holy Scripture, as well as the new one on Emmerdale. Is the prophetess Huldah a real person or a character in a book? She appears in the second book of Kings and also in the second book of Chronicles. A book has been found during King Josiah's restoration of the temple. Who will say what it means? The king and his priests go to Huldah, the prophetess, the wife of Shallum, who lived in the new quarter. She will know, and she does. We hear her speak with authority and without deference. She has the voice of a prophet. Then we turn the page and she's gone. The book was Deuteronomy, we surmise, Moses' last will and testament. Whether or not Huldah ever lived, and I think it's likely that she did, we're looking back into the 600s BCE for her. The rabbis give her more of a story, and later Christian and Muslim traditions disagree about her burial place. Huldah, you might say, is buried in the book. Half a millennium later, we find Phoebe, the deacon, who carried the Apostle Paul's letter to the Romans and, I imagine, read it out to them. I love reading that letter and imagining hearing Paul's gnarly rhetoric in a woman's voice. It seems that it should be easier to find the historic Phoebe, but it's not. She too is buried in scripture. How real their voices are, though. Only the fear of public mockery keeps me from saying, I'm inspired in my vocation by the prophetess Huldah and by Phoebe, the deacon. It's much more comfortable to tell people that it was the life of Don Camillo that got me going. And after all, we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, by Dr. Sin and Parson Yorick, Mr. Slope, Archdeacon Grantley, Mr. Crawley and Dr. Arabin, Chaucer's monk and parson, with all the saints, known and unknown, real and or apocryphal, and Jesus, who was buried in the book, and somehow, mysteriously, rose up from it. Meanwhile, the local Amdram Society is putting on the Vicar of Dibley this May. Their poster is a photo of St. Vigor's. I think they're taking the proverbial.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Prospect Lives. Join us next month as we discover what trials, tribulations, and hopefully triumphs our writers have expressed. If you enjoyed this aspect of Prospect Lives, I'm sure you'll enjoy Media Confidential with me, Alan Rusbridger, alongside Lionel Barber, the former editor of the Financial Times. We take you behind the headlines and beyond the clickbait to uncover the real facts behind a story. A new episode is out every Thursday, so be sure to subscribe and follow Media Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. Prospect Lives is brought to you by Prospect Magazine and produced by Sarah Collins and Martin Points Roberts for Fresh Air. Goodbye, stay safe, and see you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.